Welcome to EncLive On Air. I'm your host today, Caroline Seymour. EncLive On Air is a podcast from EncLive, which provides oncology professionals with the resources and information they need to provide the best patient care. In both digital and print formats, EncLive covers every angle of oncology practice, from new technology to treatment advances to important regulatory decisions. In today's episode, sponsored by Takeda, we had the pleasure of speaking with Michael A. Sakaris, MD, Professor of Medicine and Chief of the Division of Hematology at the Sylvester Comprehensive Cancer Center of the University of Miami Health System, to discuss current clinical challenges and emerging treatments in myelodysplastic syndromes. Potential combinations with pevonedistat, aprenedipopt, venetoclax, or magrolimab, plus hypomethylating agents like azacitidine are being evaluated to determine whether they can improve upon the lackluster median survival for patients with higher risk MDS, explained Sakaris. Sakaris added that although overall survival remains the gold standard endpoint, trials are evolving to incorporate event-free survival and other relevant endpoints for this patient population. In our exclusive interview, Sakaris discussed the current unmet needs of patients with higher risk MDS receiving hypomethylating agents, the potential utility of novel combinations in development, and the incorporation of other endpoints beyond overall survival in clinical trials. What would you say is the current role of hypomethylating agents in the treatment of patients with higher risk MDS?
When I first see a patient who has higher risk myelodysplastic syndromes, the very first drug I turn to is a hypomethylating agent. We have three to choose from. One is azacitidine, a second is decitabine, and a third is an oral decitabine and cetazuridine combination. Now, the first two have actually been around for a long time, about 50 years, and it's taken us a long time to figure out the right dose and schedule to give to patients, the right disease to choose, and we finally were able to settle on myelodysplastic syndromes. So both azacitidine and decitabine were approved by the FDA back in 2004-2005 for all subtypes of MDS, but there are a couple of studies that have led us to land on treating these folks with higher risk MDS first with these drugs. The first is the AZA-001 study that was conducted in Europe and was a randomized trial in which patients with higher risk MDS received either azacitidine or conventional care regimens. Those conventional care regimens could consist of either best supportive care, which 60% of those patients received. The other 40% received either low-dose cytarabine or AML type 7+3 therapy. On that study, the only prospective randomized trial to ever show a survival advantage in higher risk MDS, those patients who received azacitidine lived a median of 24 months versus 15 months for those patients who received conventional care regimens. For decitabine, a similar study that was conducted in Europe had actually quite different results. Those patients with higher risk MDS who were randomized to receive decitabine lived a median of 10.1 months compared to only 8.5 months for those patients randomized to receive best supportive care. And those differences were not significantly different as opposed to the AZA-001 study. So how do we tie all of this together? Well, we think azacitidine and decitabine are very similar drugs and should have similar outcomes, and that these studies just simply enroll different patient populations. My conclusion from this is that when I'm meeting a patient with higher risk MDS for the first time, I do recommend azacitidine as my first choice, but I don't criticize people who choose decitabine instead because it should work just as well as azacitidine. Now we have a new drug in the oral decitabine cetazuridine combination that was just approved by the FDA. This drug was approved based on PK and PD data showing that it was similar to IV decitabine, but without survival data. So while we can technically use this drug for patients with higher risk MDS, I do reserve it for patients with lower risk MDS because we just simply don't have comparative data to show that it's as good as either azacitidine or IV decitabine.
And what benefits does transfusion yield for patients with higher risk MDS? Should transfusion independence be a goal of treatment?
Patients with higher risk MDS almost invariably present with profound cytopenias and may already require transfusions before I even meet them. And those could be either blood transfusions or platelet transfusions. About 80% of patients with MDS have some degree of anemia at presentation or early in their disease course. So these folks continue to receive transfusions sometimes as we're starting therapy and well into therapy. We measure benefit in these patients, those with higher risk MDS, by whether or not they achieve a complete response. But we also measure benefit in terms of whether or not patients achieve transfusion independence or a reduction in frequency of transfusions. And that definition is called hematologic improvement. Patients achieve a hematologic improvement if they start a study already dependent on blood transfusions and then go an 8-week period on that study becoming transfusion independent, so not requiring transfusions. Now, you may take a step back from this definition and say, wait a second, is it really worth my patient getting a shot in the stomach, which is how we give azacitidine often, or a shot in the arm if they have an IV, for 7 days out of every month just so they can go an 8-week period without requiring a blood transfusion? And a lot of us in this field think that's actually not worth it. So a couple of years ago, a bunch of us internationally proposed a revision to those criteria where a patient would actually have to go 16 weeks, so about 4 months, without requiring a transfusion to achieve transfusion independence. And we do think that this represents an improvement in quality of life for patients.
What unmet needs regarding survival are research efforts aimed at addressing?
So I just described a drug that was shown in a randomized prospective trial to provide a survival advantage compared to conventional care regimens. And in the AZA-001 study, the survival advantage median was 24 months versus 15 months, so a 9-month survival advantage. Now, I would love to know what magic dust was sprinkled on these patients in this AZA-001 trial, because no randomized trial subsequent to this has ever shown a median survival for azacitidine-based therapy that's reached 24 months. And to be realistic, much more typically, a patient will have a response that lasts about 17 months to azacitidine if that patient is among the 35 to 40% of people who achieve a response. So we've got to do better for patients with higher risk MDS, many of whom have a median survival that's certainly less than 2 years, and for a lot, less than a year and a half. So what we're looking for really as a primary goal of trials in higher risk MDS is an improvement in overall survival. What we're starting to accept are what is a true interim marker of overall survival. Classically, we've looked at complete response as an interim marker of improved overall survival. But unfortunately, a number of studies, both in higher risk MDS and in older adults with acute myeloid leukemia who have a disease that's biologically very similar to higher risk MDS, have shown that patients can achieve upwards of double the complete response rate without improving their overall survival at all. Trials that are more recent are focusing on things like event-free survival. How long does a patient live or live without transformation from higher risk MDS to acute myeloid leukemia, which can serve as an interim marker of improved overall survival?
What investigational combination regimens do you find most compelling?
There are a number of trials that are combining drugs with azacitidine, and I think a potential future in therapy for higher risk MDS is to combine drugs with a hypomethylating agent-based backbone. So one combination of drugs involves the NED8 activating enzyme inhibitor pevonedistat combined with azacitidine. And in a trial in higher risk MDS patients, patients were randomized to receive pevonedistat and azacitidine versus azacitidine alone. I was fortunate to be involved with this study. In this study, among patients with higher risk MDS, there was a significant improvement in event-free survival compared to overall survival at a median of 20 months for those patients who received pevonedistat and azacitidine versus 14.8 months for those patients who received azacitidine. This study was not powered to show an improvement in overall survival, yet numerically this was also improved in patients who got the combination at 24 months compared to 19 months for those patients who received azacitidine. Another attempt at a combination of therapy is the drug APR-246 that was combined with azacitidine specifically to treat patients who have the TP53 abnormality. APR-246 restores wild-type P53 conformation and activity. In single-arm study, in which again I was privileged to participate, the overall response rate approached 85 to 90% in patients who received the combination. unfortunately, in a randomized trial, preliminary data that have been released as a news relief, so not peer-reviewed, has shown that while the response rate was improved for those patients who received the combination at 33% compared to 22% for those patients who received azacitidine monotherapy, the overall survival did not appear to be improved. So more to come on that as the phase 3 trial data are released. Another combination approach that's become a standard in older adults with acute myeloid leukemia is to combine azacitidine plus venetoclax, which is a BCL2 inhibitor. There was a phase 1b study of the combination of azacitidine and venetoclax that was presented at the American Society of Hematology annual meeting that showed a CR rate of 42%, an additional 14% of patients who had a hematologic improvement. So this is single arm data, impressive response rates so far, and we're waiting to see what a randomized trial will yield comparing azacitidine and venetoclax to azacitidine alone. One final combination I'd like to talk about is the combination of magrolimab, which is an anti-CD47 monoclonal antibody that was combined with azacitidine. Magrolimab is a major macrophage immune checkpoint and, quote, don't eat me signal in myeloid malignancies. In this trial, patients with higher risk MDS and acute myeloid leukemia were treated with a combination. Once again, a very high response rate that approaches 90% was reported for the combination versus what we would typically see with azacitidine alone, which, as I mentioned before, was about 35 to 40%. Once again, there's a randomized trial that has been initiated comparing azacitidine and magrolimab to azacitidine alone. We are eagerly awaiting results of that trial to be reported.
How would you say pevonedistat in combination with azacitidine is performing in patients with higher risk MDS?
So in the trial that looked at azacitidine and pevonedistat versus azacitidine alone, we presented some data at the European Hematology Association, or EHA, meeting in 2021, in which we demonstrated that response was actually associated with a lower likelihood of molecular evolution, so acquiring additional molecular abnormalities, and also with a shrinking of the variant allelic frequency percentage of known molecular mutations. Once again, that was among responders compared to non-responders to azacitidine and pevonedistat versus azacitidine alone.
How would you say pevonedistat is tolerated among patients? What are the potential clinical implications of the activity demonstrated with pevonedistat?
One of the reasons I think so far we've seen good results from the combination of azacitidine and pevonedistat is that the combination is so well tolerated. I led a North American intergroup trial in higher risk MDS patients that randomized patients to receive azacitidine monotherapy, azacitidine combined with lenalidomide, or azacitidine combined with a histone deacetylase inhibitor, vorinostat. In that study, while we did show an improvement in overall response rate for azacitidine and lenalidomide compared to azacitidine alone of 11%, it wasn't significantly different because the study was powered to show an improvement in overall response rate of 20%. What we learned from that study, though, is that patients who are receiving combinations of therapy who have higher risk MDS are at risk of having that therapy dosing lowered or therapy stopped because of side effects to the therapy. And often, the side effects that are justified to lower or stop therapy are not serious, at least not as reported on the clinical trial. And those dose reductions or stopping treatment occurs in ways that aren't specified by a clinical trial. In other words, a doctor just decided to do it. So in the azacitidine and pevonedistat trial, we had much stricter language in the protocol itself so that doctors had to check with a medical monitor before they lowered or stopped dosing of the combination. But we also found that side effects to the combination were about the same as what we saw with azacitidine monotherapy. Because the combination was better tolerated, patients remained on it longer, and that's probably why we saw the emergence of better responses even than azacitidine monotherapy. I think there are a couple of clinical implications to that sort of study with combination therapy. First, we've got to give something that's tolerable. Secondly, we've got to stick with it in older adults with AML so that they are on therapy long enough so that we start to see improvements in event-free survival and overall survival.
And what clinical endpoints are important to evaluate beyond overall survival for emerging therapies?
For patients with higher risk MDS, overall survival is really the gold standard. We would really love our patients to be able to live longer. We would also love them to live better, in other words, to have improved quality of life. And these are the two standards that FDA uses for approving drugs for any cancer indication. Unfortunately, quality of life studies and quality of life instruments that we have to measure MDS haven't really demonstrated that routinely, and I think there are a couple of reasons why. First of all, a lot of studies have been locked into using the EORTC-QLQ-C30 quality of life instrument, and this just simply isn't very sensitive to changes in patients with MDS who are undergoing treatment. A better instrument, for example, would be the QALMS, which was developed by Gregory Abel at the Dana-Farber Cancer Institute. Secondly, quality of life instruments and measurements are tricky in patients with higher risk MDS because in one arm you may have a patient who's being given a drug and responds to that drug, and therefore her blood counts improve or she doesn't need transfusions as often. In the arm in which patients aren't responding, however, they're still getting blood transfusions, and those blood transfusions are themselves improving their quality of life, so that equilibrates the differences in quality of life that you may see between the arms. So overall survival is still the gold standard. I would love to see, for example, use of wearable devices to measure quality of life so we can see how patients are really performing at home, not when they're putting on their best face in my clinic setting. And as I mentioned earlier, I think an interim marker may emerge in event-free survival for something that's clinically meaningful.
Are there other areas of ongoing research you're keeping your eye on?
I think one other area that's evolving is the use of targeted or genetically directed therapy. We have data on 17 patients who were treated with enasidenib. Those patients all had IDH2 positivity. This is relatively infrequent in MDS compared to in AML, probably occurs in about 5% of patients. But where we can identify those patients, we have an opportunity to either treat them after hypomethylating agents have failed them, or to combine those drugs with hypomethylating agents and see if we can get a more robust response that's more durable upfront with those patients. And we're starting to see this more and more with other types of drugs that are targeting therapy. Not all of them have been successful. For example, there was a recent drug made by H3 Biosciences that targeted patients who had spliceosome mutations, but there are second generation drugs that are coming out focusing on spliceosome mutations and those that are trying to take advantage of the immunologic mediated aspects of myelodysplastic syndrome, such as sabatolimab, which is now also in a phase 3 trial combined with azacitidine.
That's all we have for today. Thank you for listening to this episode of OncLive On Air, sponsored by Takeda. Check back on Mondays and Thursdays for exclusive interviews with leading experts in the oncology field and recaps from our State of the Science Summits and Institutional Perspectives in Cancer webinars. For more updates in oncology, be sure to visit www.onclive.com and sign up for our e-newsletters. OncLive is also on social media. On Twitter, follow us at OncLive and OncLive SOSS. On Facebook, like us at OncLive and OncLive State of the Science Summit, and follow our OncLive page on LinkedIn. If you like today's episode of OncLive On Air, please consider subscribing to our podcast on Apple Podcasts or Spotify so you get a notification every time a new episode is posted. While you are there, please take a moment to rate us. Thanks again for listening to OncLive On Air.